to our beautiful deep community, I want to assure you the deeper is going nowhere. And the same incredible content will be released every week, but now through Arise. It is going to be less trauma heavy and more inspirational, uplifting, but it will still challenge and push you to grow. For all your deeper episodes, they are still available every fortnight. You can still get your deep hit with the deeper subscription.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In the 80s, it was a really lawless town, King's Cross. It was run by a whole row of corrupt police and drug dealers, and kids were the commodity back then. The kids were the ones that were being abused, and they brought the money to the dealers, and the dealers took the money to the police and the gangsters, you know. The kids were just a commodity in King's Cross, and they were dying, and lots of them have died. Too many have died on the streets of King's Cross.
Welcome to The Deep. I'm Zoe Marshall. In my early 20s, a lot of traumatic things happened. And ever since then, I have had this fascination with people and their stories. This is The Deep. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I work and live, and recognise their continuing connection to land, water, and community. I pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. Glenn grew up on the streets of Sydney. What he's had to survive is absolutely horrendous. Homelessness, drug addiction, crime, child abuse, and the absurdity of our judicial system. He's lived through the worst aspects of humanity and has wise words for the rest of us. Content warning, this episode discusses child sexual abuse and addiction. Glenn, welcome to The Deep.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. You have a very colourful history and life. And I found you because I was on TikTok, and you're quite big on TikTok. And you were talking about a very famous place in Sydney that I was always fascinated by as a young woman and even a child, which was The Wall.
Yeah, so The Wall's in Darlinghurst, just near King's Cross, and it was a place where young boys used to go and work or solicit themselves as children. It's a very sad place, to be honest, because I've seen kids as young as 12 up there, you know, and a lot of powerful and influential men would go there, pick up children, and a lot of lives have been destroyed at that place. A lot of children, mostly, who were hooked on heroin, and that was their reasoning for being there.
I never saw children there, but I was always fascinated driving past The Wall. It was a real moment, you know, in the 90s, especially, where you would just see all of these different men, usually, and boys or males. And then I heard you speaking about it, and I was like, wow, not many people talk about The Wall and talk about, you know, we've got Underbelly and the kind of, you know, glamorized version of King's Cross, but you really lived the reality of your youth and young adulthood there. Could you take us back to how you found yourself in these places, in these circles?
I can. It's a kind of a complicated story to get there, but I mean, from a very young age, my father went into prison when I was 7, and because of that, I ended up in orphanages. My mother went into psychiatric care. My mother was a heroin addict, alcoholic, suffered schizophrenia, and my dad was charged with a really heinous crime. So that's sort of where it led me to for orphanages. And then what ends up happening is I begin running away. At 9, I go back to my mum, where I was brutally attacked. I was raped when I was 9. I had some other things happen to me that were really graphic and violent. And I started running away from home, and what that did was it put me into boys' homes like Darick, Yasma, Minda, Cobham, Verdura, Albion Street, all those kind of institutions. Yeah, and then at about the age of 14, just when I'm nearly turning 14, I actually ran away after I got released from Darick because I was abused again in Darick. And I went up to the Brian Hubble, my welfare officer, and I said, look, I'm not trying to get in trouble. I said, I don't want to keep running away. I'm not trying to get in trouble. You know, just help me, please. So they ended up putting me in foster care in Mount Druitt. But the house where they put me, there was 9 adults living there, and I was put into a back bedroom with 3 adult men. And 2 of those men had prior convictions for pedophilia. Oh. And so I end up getting abused again when I'm in there. And, and then I end up leaving there and trying to get back to my mum. And then what happens is my mother has a fight with her boyfriend in Whyalla and kicks me out and tells me to get out, me and my brother. So we get a train back to Sydney to meet my real dad. And as I started following my dad to Oxford Street, to the car, he turned around and says to me, I don't know where you think you're going, mate, but you're not coming with me. F off. And pretty much that's where I land on the streets of King's Cross.
Beautiful Glenn. What? I mean, I already have 100 questions for the first part of this. 100 questions. Such a little boy, you know, you're... Firstly... Growing up with your parents before the age of 7, your mum was using before that time?
Yeah. Yeah, my mum was a heroin addict when I was born, and she swapped the rich for the bitch, so she ended up giving up the heroin and pills and became a heavy alcoholic. And but she kept on the pills, but she became a heavy drinker and a violent one at that.
So you were born into an impossible situation.
Yeah, pretty much.
So you have a brother. How old's he? What's the age difference?
18 months. So I have 2 brothers and a sister. I'm the oldest, and he's 18 months younger than me. And then so it's 66, 68, 70, 71.
So your mum, I mean, without the drugs, that amount of children, 4 under 5, I'm not good at the maths, is... challenging, even if you're mentally stable and supported, let alone you are an addict. So she has all these babies and is heavily addicted from a very young age. Was it neglectful and abusive? Was it both?
Absolutely. So I'm removed by docs 22 times before the age of 7. I have a docs file that's like huge. If you actually read my book, the one I've written, I've actually put extracts of my docs files into it. I have 75 pages just on the actual physical violence that was seen. And the systemic failures in my case in docs is incredible. And I'm actually going through litigation against them now. As you'll hear when we get further on, I've been through 4 trials. I've been through 2 royal commissions. I've put a whole lot of my abusers in jail. But, it's... The systemic fails by docs in my particular case is it's bogus belief, to be honest, how any one incident. Like, my mother tried to cut my fingers off with a pair of knife, with a carving knife when I was the age of 9. Like, she literally attacked me. She was addicted to Bex and Vincent's. And what actually happened was, when the Mr. Whippy truck was coming around, who used to sell them at the time, she lost the plot because she couldn't find any money. And she turned at me and she threw a knife at me first. And then she actually grabs me by my hair and drags me to the bathroom and literally holds me over a sink and carves into my fingers. And which is all recorded in my docs file, which is so bizarre. And also is that my mother was giving me tablets. And when I was raped by Uncle Pat, this is all recorded in my docs files and nobody's done nothing to protect me.
Who is Uncle Pat?
So Uncle Pat was the family friend of my mum and dad, and he was promiscuous right from my birth. I believe that my parents were kid swapping. So I have memories back to the young age of stuff happening with me and my his daughters, Deborah and Judy, from a very young age. There's a lot of sexual activity in my life before the age of 14.
So not only were your parents horrifically abusive and neglectful, but the system kept putting you in dangerous positions. So you would think that you would be pulled from abuse and placed somewhere safe, but you were placed in constant neglectful, abusive situations. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, what ends up happening is, like, they keep turning me back to my mum. I went to orphanages a couple of times. I get removed for 2 weeks, sent back to my mum. But then eventually they start putting me in institutions for uncontrollable. I don't commit any crimes. They just put me in there because I'm running away from home. And I'm in with kids that have done murder and all the most serious crimes. And all I've done is just run away from violence. I'm just sick to death of being abused. So I run away from it. And they put me into institutions that are literally just as abusive. It's insane.
It's funny. Yesterday I was driving up the street and I saw a little kid running away from his dad. And he looked distressed. And because of the work I do, my lens is often dark. You know, everyone else would see that as, oh, a little boy being cheeky, running away, doesn't want to do what his dad's saying. I spiraled and started to think, what if this little boy feels unsafe and is trying to run away? But this man is bigger and faster and stronger, right? Not even an addict, not even dangerous. This was a nice suburb, but they keep bringing the child back. He has no access to phones. He has no access to police. He has no access to get help. He just feels unsafe. Your situation, that I don't even know if was real, but I just spiraled into this, maybe because I knew I was speaking to you today, about how completely helpless you are as a child and a teenager. You know, how do you survive constantly getting abused?
You just do. You know, like, I mean, there's something, if I have anything in me, I'm resilient. And I think the one talent that I've had my whole life is resilience. I've just had this inner strength that just somehow kept surviving. I guess it's the nature, isn't it, that we just survive regardless.
Can I ask you something? This is going to be a very weird thing to ask, but, you know, we talk to a lot of survivors of child sexual abuse on the deep.
Yeah.
And I'm always inquiring, because I'm such an overprotective parent, especially because of my work, that were you ever in a situation of abuse, sexual abuse, where you were lured with treats and presents, or you're my favorite and all the grooming, and you somehow made it okay because it was getting treats and you were getting your favorite lollies, or you were going to go see a movie? Like, are children able to compartmentalize and go, oh, I'll do that really uncomfortable thing if I get that thing?
Yeah. So when I got to King's Cross, if you'll know, there's part of my story where it gets into courts and stuff, is that in 1982, I moved into a refuge. This refuge was set up by a leading privacy advocate, a judge, and a prime minister. It's got seven judges on board, and it's run by five pedophile men. The man that ran that refuge, Simon Davies, did exactly that. He knew exactly how to pump my tires. He used to tell me how I was a beautiful boy, how all the other kids were so warming to me, and I was like a leader. And he bought me a shiny new BMX, and he did exactly that. But the whole time I was there, I ended up being abused literally by the whole staff of that place. And, you know, which leads to the death of my girlfriend. I don't know if you know, but my girlfriend, she was 15, she was murdered. And her killers were caught and convicted. And then they went before a judge named Judge Yeldham, who set them free on appeal. And he himself was a predator who ended up taking his own life after being exposed with the Woodrow Commission.
It's a fucking nightmare.
It is, yeah.
It's like no respite for you. It's no break in this fucking nightmare of these dangerous, disgusting humans. Like, I don't, resilience is one thing, but I don't even know. Like, did you turn to drugs and alcohol? Did you find ways to block, numb, cope, continue? Tell me about that.
So what actually happens is my girlfriend gets murdered in 1984. After she gets murdered, I actually go up to the two guys that ran the refuge after it closes. And I said to them, I said, one day I'm going to hold you accountable. I'm going to tell the world what you did. And one day I'm going to write a book. What ends up happening is I end up becoming a heroin addict for the next 35 years of my life. And I spend the next 35 years in and out of prison, in and off the streets, and addicted to heroin. So, yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was an inevitable path for a survivor like me to end up a heroin addict.
Like, what age was that? Did you start? Was the
So 15 I started using, and by 17 I was a full-on heroin addict.
Like, I don't blame you. I would be too. And I very seriously mean that. I have spoken to a few heroin addicts, meth addicts, that have been through incredible trauma and have said, if it wasn't for the drug, I would be dead. I would have killed myself. The drug, in fact, saved me because it kept, like, me sane in a very strange way, right? Like,
yeah.
What other options do you have? And I think that's the thing we really need to take away from this stigma of, I'm not saying all drug addicts, but a lot of them are coping with the only tools they have to cope. You know, it's a privilege for me to be able to access psychological therapies. It's a privilege, right? You're talking to a 15-year-old boy that has, at this point, been sexually abused how many times, would you say, by 15?
I couldn't even tell you. Yeah, I mean, literally, I couldn't tell you. A lot.
Like hundreds.
At least hundreds, yeah.
You know, and you go, no wonder. What other choice did you have? You weren't taken and placed with a healthy family unit. And even if you were, say at 8, say there was a year, you know, there was all of that abuse before your mum as well, but I don't even know if that would be enough time to recover, like what children go through. We all know that the brain is developed and that kind of the blueprint for children is between 0 and 7. And you've already got, like, it's pretty major. So to go into heroin addiction is understandable. What is heroin addiction like for you?
Well, what it was, I mean, I lived on the streets of the cross for, you know, 14 years, and I was doing whatever I could to use. You know, I became a dealer. I became doing crime. I did all sorts of things. It's one of the reasons that I speak up today, Zoe, is that I want people to know that what actually happens with survivors of abuse is we become our own worst abusers. After my abuse stops around the age of 16, 17, I become my worst abuser. That I'm living on the streets. I've overdosed 13 times. I've tried to suicide twice. I'm really struggling with life. You know, right up until January 2010, I am struggling with life. It was only then when I put the needle down.
It's a dark, it must feel like another lifetime, you know, speaking to me here, being sober, hosting an NRL podcast, having opportunities, like, having your life, having light back in. You've got all these chapters, you know, you've got the childhood mother stuff, father stuff, Uncle Pat, going into homes, going into institutions, having heroin, being homeless, living on the streets. Like, it's a lot of life to put into one person.
Absolutely.
You have these experiences, which is where I guess I found you, where you knew the boys that were at the wall. I'm sure some of them were your peers. Did you ever sell yourself there at that age, or were you still in the institutions at that point?
So I went to prison in 1988 and I got out in 1992. In 1992, I haven't been back or in trouble since, but I was on the methadone program right up to 2010. And then I started going through court cases in 1996. I went through the Woodrow Commission, Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse, and I went through four separate trials and an extradition against my abusers. and I've put 5 of them in jail.
Fuck yeah. Your drug addiction was 15. Between 15 and your first incarceration, what age was that?
20.
20, 5 years.
Yeah.
Did you have to sell yourself?
Yes. Yeah, I did at the start. When I very first started using, I didn't know, and I got a habit, I didn't know how to take care of it. So the only people I knew to help me were predators. But what's end up happening is I end up doing selling drugs and becoming a drug dealer.
So it goes from selling body, selling drugs, crime. What would you say some of the worst crimes were, or was it more petty crime? I'm not saying that no, like small crimes aren't bad, but what are we talking about?
Well, I went to jail for armed robbery. I've been done for assault and robbery. I've done extortion, demand money with menaces. I used to rob dealers, Zoe. I used to run into dealers' places and just go for them. And what happens is hurt people, and that's what I was. I was walking around stick of dynamite, and I was so much in pain that I just wanted to inflict as much as I could on other people. But it's not who my core person was.
I feel you. I just get this. I mean, it's pretty ballsy to rob the drug dealers, though. It feels like that could have been like maybe a bad choice. They're the ones that are going to kill you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, there's crime happening, break and enters, stealing the whole lot, whatever it took, yeah?
Yeah.
Did you assaulted somebody for, what was that situation? Was that assaulting them to get money?
Yeah. So it was always about money. I used to go to get it off them, and then I just grabbed them. Usually I just grabbed them, and I was big and strong back then when I got out of prison is when I really started to go hectic doing that kind of stuff. And, I had no fear. And, like, you're right, I'm lucky I wasn't killed, because there was many opportunities for that to have happened to me. And but it's weird. I got to a point in my life where I didn't care anymore about my own life. Like I said, I tried to suicide twice. I overdosed 13 times. I literally got to a point in time where I just thought life was just not working for me. And, you know, and I didn't really care about consequences at that point in my life.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We're jumping back here for a second, but your girlfriend was murdered. Like, your whole story could be an actual film.
Yeah.
Your girlfriend is murdered by who?
So what actually happened was two men sent out to get a little girl to sleep with for the night. And they paid her in heroin. What ends up happening is they sleep with her, give her heroin, and she overdoses and dies. Rather than getting help for her, they just leave her unattended. They get caught and convicted. They get 20 years in jail. And then they appeal, like I said, and they're set free by that Judge Yeldon, who ends up suiciding himself.
So hang on. So your girlfriend was the girl that they took to rape for drugs?
Yeah.
And yeah. She OD'd with them, and they just left her like she was nothing.
That's exactly
And then
right.
They get caught, they get 20 years, they appeal their case, and then they walk free.
Absolutely, that's what happens. And because that judge suicides, I can't get any, I can't do anything about it because it's the double jeopardy law. It's fucking ridiculous. The killers of my girls got free.
I'm thinking about you as a really little baby, as a toddler, as a boy, as a teen, with the love you lacked, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, as a mum, I just, like, I can see the little you, you know?
Yeah.
And it just breaks me open to think about that. Where did you find love? Was that girlfriend the first?
Yes.
One?
Absolutely. I've only had 5 partners in my whole life, and she was my first. And that was the first time I ever saw love. It was the first time I experienced everything with her, you know, like it was my first relationship, sexual relationship, first time I felt love back, first time I loved somebody, you know. And to lose her like that was very hard. It was
very traumatic.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I watched so many kids die on the streets after that.
It's so strange because we are supposedly in the lucky country, you know.
Yeah.
And supposedly we have incredible resources and we pay a fuckload of tax for all of the things.
Yeah.
But the things we really don't care about is rehabilitating people.
That's right.
Is housing people, is domestic violence, is, you know, all of these things. There's this kind of facade that we live in this beautiful place, and it is, you know, our surrounds are stunning. But there's this kind of, we hit like a level and then it's like the forgotten people, you know, they're left. And if you're saying you have seen multiple children die on the streets in a country and a city like Sydney, I don't understand this, you know. I don't, it's very hard to comprehend, and I'm living in my bubble, but you are living in yours, and your bubble is very vicious. Do you, and I know the work you do now is because of everything that you lived through, but these kids, were these kids just like you?
Absolutely. You know, I think of one girl, her name was Bam. She was only 15. She used to strip at the Pink Pussycat, who died. There's multiple of them, you know. Like in the 80s, it was a really lawless town, King's Cross. It was run by a whole rogue of corrupt police and drug dealers. And kids were the commodity back then. The kids were the ones that were being abused, and they brought the money to the dealers, and the dealers took the money to the police and the gangsters, you know. The kids were just a commodity in King's Cross, and they were dying, and lots of them have died. Too many have died on the streets of King's Cross.
Let's move on to prison. What's prison like? Do you like it there? Does it feel safe?
So sadly, I did. When I first got to prison, it was quite hard because the first 12 months I was in jail, I was going through withdrawals. I was very sick. I spent 18 hours in a day in a cell. I don't have any visitors. I don't have any money. But what ends up happening is I've come from so much using on the street, nowhere to sleep. I've suddenly got a roof over my head. I'm being fed three times a day. I've got 100 mates. I'm playing chess, touch football. It actually became a life that I adjusted to quite easily. Which is sad, really.
It is. But I understand people finding comfort in jail. Did you kicked the drugs, you get out at what age?
Well, I only stopped using 13 years ago.
Okay, so in and that's, out of prison and drugs, right? So kind of flipping in and out. And then... Yeah. You're still experiencing homelessness at that time as well when you're out?
No, well, when I first get out of jail, yeah, I am. But I end up meeting someone, having four kids and sort of trying to live a normal life, but I'm doing that on the methadone program. But jail changes who you are inside. The person you have to become to adapt to be able to survive in prison really changes you. That's why I came out and started doing such violent crimes, because I'd learned violence in jail. That's what I learned. That was the thing I learned, was to be violent. That's how you survive.
So who do you meet and have four kids with, and at what stage is that?
So that's in 1992. I don't talk about my partner and kids, because she's asked me to keep our life separate from that life, if that's okay.
That's okay, of course. So if you can give me your learnings then, we don't need to talk about her and the kids, but your learnings through trying to have a normal existence. What is that like for you with someone that hasn't actually dealt with the trauma yet?
It's hard to be a father when you've never seen what a father looks like. It's hard to live in a house and live a normal life when you don't know what that looks like. But I did it. I did it on methadone though. I was always on a program trying to live as normal life as I could. And I'm lucky. My kids have grown up very well balanced, and they're very loved by me and I'm loved by them, which is remarkable. But at the start, it wasn't so easy. You know, I didn't know what I was doing.
Look, you can just not answer this, but I feel like I have to ask it because I've had experiences of this with lots of other people that have had trauma, is that they notice when they're going to have a child, things really rare up. And then when that child hits different ages in which they were abused or traumatized, they then are reliving because they're watching this child at this age do their sports or their homework or normal things, and the person that's been traumatized is marrying that up to what their experience was, going, holy fuck, I was so little, or I was this, or I was that. Was that an experience for you?
Absolutely. So when I became a father, I started seeing my children at certain ages, and I started to think, my fucking God, man, you don't realize how defenseless a child is at 7, at 9, at 13, until you're a father yourself and you witness them at that age, and you think they think they know everything at that age, but you and I both know they know shit. And and I realized just how unequipped I was to protect myself against that kind of stuff as a child.
So did that fuck you up? Like, did that bring things to the surface?
Absolutely. It was the catalyst for me coming forward to the Withdrawal Commission. It was the catalyst for me going forward to the trials. It was the reason where I started thinking to myself, I've got to stop these guys. I grew up in a world where you don't tell anybody anything. You don't dob, you don't speak, don't show emotion. Then I started thinking, I have an obligation to speak up against this stuff, because if I don't, these men are going to continue to abuse and hurt other people. And as a father, I have an obligation to protect every fucking child out there. Sorry for swearing, but that's how I felt, you know, like.
Okay. Can I ask something else just as a parent? Because this is how I feel. I think everyone's a pedophile, like literally. Like, no, I don't trust anybody with my kids. Yeah. Did you feel that growing up, being like raising your kids?
I was so hypervigilant.
You can't do sleepovers. There's no this. There's no aunties, uncles staying. I don't care if, you know, they're family or they're not. Like, was that you?
Absolutely. I was a helicopter parent. I was hypervigilant. I was so overprotective. And my kids have grown up beautifully, but that's definitely their memory of dad. You know, they want to stay over with friends. And I'm like, no. And if they did, I had to go to that place. I had to know exactly who was there and who was going to be what time. I just never felt. I don't trust anyone, and I still don't, Zoe, to this day. I just don't trust adults, men around children. And it's sad because 90% of adult men are good people. It's just that 10% have done so much damage that I don't trust anyone.
Did you ever inquire with them when they would get back from things, you know, whether if they were at a camp or they had been somewhere or after-school activity? Would you be like, would you inquire things without trying to fuck them up, yeah, you know, like push your shit on them? Like, how did you do that?
I'd always be present. I took them to their sports. I'd always be present where they were or their mum was. We were both pretty hypervigilant, to be fair. But, okay, you know, my kids did miss out on a lot of things because I was too scared to let them go to them.
Is that a regret, or you stand by that?
A bit of both. I mean, the fact that they are how they are and beautiful the way they are, I mean, it's a good thing. But, I mean, you know, I would have liked to have given more of freedom, I guess. I was too scared.
We talk about breaking generational trauma a lot. And somehow, Glenn, somehow, by the grace of God or whoever we believe in, the universe, you didn't continue the cycle of trauma.
Yeah, everything I do, Zoe, is about breaking generational abuse, breaking generational trauma, breaking generational addiction. I do not want that for my children or for anyone's child.
How do you do that? Like, as a addict or a recovering addict or a past addict, how do you do that?
With brutal honesty. That's the way. You'd have a relationship where your kids and you are talking about everything. My children know my story. We have had some great conversations around that, hence the reason why I try not to bring my kids into my pods or things that I do. I try to keep the two separate for that reason, to protect them, you know. But I do have very honest conversations. They know my whole story, you know, and two of my kids came with me to my book launch and helped me do my book.
Wow. Four kids is a lot of kids, Glenn, you know. It's a lot of kids. It's a lot of kids for anybody. And to have raised them with that amount of trauma and they turn out healthy is like, that says a lot about you, you know, and your ex-partner, of course.
Yeah.
Huge. And also I think just such a beautiful moment to really like simmer on is that it can be different. I think a lot of the times we think that addicts create addicts or abusers create abusers, and it actually just doesn't have to be that way, you know?
Absolutely. As you know, I do a lot of TikToks. I've written a book. I do a lot of work on the streets helping homeless. And the reason I do all that is because I do have a wealth of experience in trauma. So I'm able to show people there's a pathway out if they want it. But it's actually our choice. We need to get up and fight, not be victims to ourselves. And that's what I was. I sat in depression and anger for so many years, and it wasn't doing me any good. No one was going to write in and help me or fix it for me. The only person that had the power to fix it was myself. And once I learned that I had that power, my life really took a shift to the right.
Talk to me then about that moment, that turning point. Was that a rock bottom? Was it an epiphany? What was it for you that was like, nah, I'm done?
When docs walked into my life. When I was a kid, docs took me off my parents over and over and over again. When I was an adult, docs turned up at our door because of my own using. That was the catalyst for me to realize I'm not doing this to my children. It's time to stop. It's time to pull my head in and take responsibility as a father. And that was the change. And then I went to rehab for 12 months and they gave me the tools that I needed to understand that my problem wasn't actually addiction. My problem was heavy set trauma. I was suffering with serious PTSD and had serious anger issues. And until they were addressed, I was not going to get anywhere.
Had you ever heard those tools, techniques that the rehab gave you? Had you heard some of those things before?
I had in and out of I'd gone to NA meetings in my life and I'd been in and out of detoxes, but never enough time of abstinence where I was clean long enough and getting that help at the same time. Like you said, in jail, there's no help there. I had to learn to survive again. But when I finally went to rehab and did a long term of abstinence where I did 12 months of constant healing, that's the first time it started to absorb, where I started to realize it was possible.
How do you get 12 months in rehab? That sounds expensive. How does that work?
One day at a time, pretty much one day at a time, you know, and it is, it's hard. I did it. I was put into a government run rehab called Carolina in Canberra, and it's run through Narcotics Anonymous as well. And I just, you know, I had cancer as well at the same time. So I had to leave after 12 months because I ended up getting cancer. I had thyroid cancer. So they had to cut that out. And I also had hepatitis C from when I was a kid that had to be treated as well.
So it's kind of like, and I love this because it really brings us full circle, which is like you can't run from your trauma. It's going to turn up as cancer or it's going to turn up as whatever it is, addiction, drug. You can't outrun it. Like even if you get clean, even if you're dealing with the therapies, like it's like it needs to purge out of your body, right? Like it needs to get out. Did you think that your cancer had something? It was thyroid. Is thyroid throat-ish?
Yeah, throat cancer. Yeah, it's throat. Yeah, they had to take out my high thyroid.
It feels like symbolic to not having a voice, right?
Yeah. I absolutely believe the cancer was symbolic from purging from abuse. I believe a lot of what's happened in my life is because of the abuse. But like I said, until we learn, because what happens is we hold it in. I held it in, Zoe, from 92 to 2009, not telling any of my partner or my friends that I'd been through this abuse until the Withdrawal Commission came in. So what happens is that becomes toxic and it has to be released in some way. For me, it was released in anger and then cancer.
So hang on. I know we're not talking about the ex-partner, but you didn't tell her originally.
No, I didn't. She didn't find out until the Woods Royal Commission. She didn't know for the bulk of our relationship.
Wow. So that came out, and then as your children got older and it was appropriate, they learned things. But
that's
through
right.
This detox, through this rehab, through these therapies, you get the cancer, you survive the cancer. Do you still have cancer?
No, I don't. I got rid of that in 2015.
Holy moly. Okay, so at this point, what point are you now clean? What year?
I got clean in January 2010. I haven't used since then, but I didn't come off the program until the beginning of this year, about 7 months ago.
Methadone?
No, but not methadone. I haven't been on methadone for 20 years. It's called Suboxone. It's kind of similar kind of process to methadone, but it's not so not as strong. It's one that you take that stops you from using on top of it. So, but I got clean about 6 months ago properly from that. But I haven't used since 2010 anything. Smoke pot, taken any kind of drugs.
Wow.
I just don't. I've been clean since then.
How does it feel to be off everything for 6 months, 10 months?
It feels good. I feel proud of myself and I just feel free. That's what it is. And I feel that now that I've got this freedom, I want it to give it to other people. I want other people to know that there is a way out, you know, and if you want it bad enough, you can have it too. And it's the trauma. My biggest message is trauma is the underlying undercurrent of all addictions, in most addictions. In serious addictions, people are self-medicating and they don't even realize that's what they're doing.
I truly believe what you're saying. And you know, I've had different traumas to you and it doesn't feel like we're even on the same scale, but I have always felt, and I know it's a personality type, to go head first into the trauma because and to the healing, because I know that it haunts you and it gets in you and it suffocates you and it destroys things, you know? And I think lots of people, majority of people, don't want to go and look at it. And it's actually, you know, it's the trauma is fucked up, right? It's fucked up, but you've already lived it and survived it, right? To look at it again isn't as scary as everyone thinks, but this kind of avoidance and the running from it, it's that cycle, right? That they can't even like look into it. How do you find now with the people that you're meeting that are stuck in this cycle? How do you get through to them now? Are you just leading by example?
It's hard to get through to people because people are still in the shame and guilt mode. You know, that's where I was for so many years. The fear of somebody knowing that I'd been through sexual abuse was terrifying. I was terrified. As a man got walking around in prison, you know, just got out of prison, I built myself into a corner where I was terrified of people knowing. And now I'm probably one of those candid people on TikTok that speaks about my story. I mean, literally, I just speak from the heart about my abuse because I share my story so other people feel safe enough to share theirs.
And you feel the freedom and the, I guess, the catharsis of sharing your story is healing?
Absolutely. It is. It is absolutely therapeutic. And it's removing it. You know how you said it has to release in some way? That's the way I find it's the healthiest way to release it, is to just openly and candidly and honestly share our stories.
Can we quickly talk about love again?
Yeah.
I don't know if you know much about attachment styles. Have you heard of them? Like there's avoidant and there's anxiously attached and it all kind of starts from 0 to 7 when you're a child. And
yeah.
If you're neglected as a baby, yeah, or like your cries aren't met, you shut down, right? You avoid emotion, you hold it all in.
Yeah.
How has it been for you as a child of neglect and abuse? How have you learnt to love and let love in?
Loving someone else I don't find hard to do, but I find trust for me is a real issue. I see myself and always have as less than, and I'm trying to find my self-esteem. So I always feel like a person looking back at me isn't looking at me how I'm looking at them. And it's always been a way for me. I'm in a beautiful relationship with a woman now, but even that, I find it's hard in life to fully immerse, you know. And what it is you've got to find that person who knows your story and who trusts and loves you back that way, and I've managed to find that.
It's hard, isn't it, because you're dealing with the inner child that how could it trust anybody?
Yeah, I feel like a child a lot of the time. I really do. Emotionally, I feel like I'm very childlike in my emotions. There's a lot of fear attached all the time. I feel a lot of the time I'm not as worthy as someone else. You know, you think about it, I've always been the foster kid, the kid in the boys' home, the orphan, the street kid, the homeless, the prisoner, the methadonian, the heroin addict, you know, to try and get myself as, you know, I'm actually Glenn and I'm actually a really beautiful person. I'm a very caring person with a really good heart. I really have. But it's trying to reconcile that between heart and head. And it's a long journey, Zoe, between the heart and the head, you know. We can know what's going on in our head, but to reconcile that in our heart is a different journey, you know.
And it's also neurological, like you're dealing with neurological pathways in the brain that have been formed. Like it's a lot of work, you know. There needs to be quite a bit of grace that comes with the road you're on, because the fact that we're here talking to you and you've achieved and succeeded with so many levels of family and being of service to others, like it's just quite profound. It's really profound and really special and really beautiful that you've arrived here. Really, really, really unique and rare, I think. Okay, I could talk to you forever, but we're in the present. You're currently, tell me about some of the work you're doing now, because I know a lot of people might feel moved to help as well. So just tell me about your current work and tell me about if we wanted to volunteer or donate or what we can do.
So I go down to the streets and I work with homeless. I look for people who are homeless, who are stuck in trauma, who are stuck in addiction, and I build connections with them. I give them things like buy them breakfast and sit down with them. I bring them all sorts of stuff, you know, from clothing. I give out gift cards. And what I just try to do is I try and run the ball up for them. I try to show them that they don't need to be stuck. And what happens is because I've walked that walk, I've lived that life, they're able to resonate with us, you know. And the partner that I have now, she does that with me. Me and my partner together do that. We're going down tomorrow to Sydney. You know, and it's something, it's in the works. I'm trying to build it into a proper org. And I just love doing it.
It's something I so want to be a part of, but I don't have that lived experience. And when I see people that are sleeping rough, and I'm with the kids especially, we had Andrew up the road for a little while. It was really important for me, just as a human being, to acknowledge another human being, which I know so many people that live on the streets say they don't get. No one looks at them. They're invisible, right?
Yeah.
And then to teach my kids about them. You know, obviously I don't know the ins and outs of why they're there and their circumstances, but they should be able to come into the shops with me. We fill up a shopping bag. We take it to Andrew with a cup of coffee. And I want him to know that he is able to be a support person to those in need. You know, everyone should be able to step outside of themselves and see others and go,
yeah,
I can do something, right? Small, a coffee, a bag of food, a lunch, like you said, right? And also he has questions like, why doesn't he have a home? All these things. So we're starting to educate from a three-year-old or a five-year-old, right, about different people in different circumstances. But I know a lot of people have fear when they see people sleeping rough. Could you give maybe some information or insight into what you think is most helpful to do if you're, a civilian walking past someone sleeping rough.
Absolutely. So you nailed it at the very first comment you made, which is that I wrote in my book, and I say it all the time, when I was on the streets, I fucking felt invisible. People would literally walk past me as a kid and they'd say, why don't you go home to your mummy, mate? Go home to your daddy. The ignorance was astounding, that they didn't understand that that wasn't an option for me. So the first thing to do is to just say to someone hi with a smile, just letting them know. The other thing I would suggest is that you meet them at their level. Don't stand above them while they're on the ground. A lot of people do that from a power position. So sit on the same level and often just say, could I get you something to eat? Ask them, what can they do to help? And you've got to be careful, because there's a difference between those. There's people on the street who are actually conning, manipulating, and those who are genuinely homeless. So I would suggest that you start with talking, just having a genuine conversation, letting them know they're not invisible and that you see them. And when you build that connection, you'll start to know in your own heart what's best suited for this person.
Beautiful. We have our final question for you, which is, everyone gets this on the deep. Who are you when no one's watching?
A scared, a frightened little boy. Sometimes that's being honest. But I'm also a very loving and compassionate, caring man. I have a really deep heart for people. I feel things very deeply. And, I believe I'm someone, I'm still trying to identify myself, right? I'm still reconciling that between I'm not worth less than other people, that I'm actually as much value as anyone else, but I'm a dad, I'm a partner, I'm a rogue, I'm a scallywag, I've got a bit of a sense of humour, I'm actually intelligent, I haven't had the schooling everyone else has had, but I'm actually, I'm articulate, that sort of drums me up. I've got a weird sense of humour. I like to be funny. I love rugby league. I love Benji Marshall.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm a Tigers supporter my whole life. Yeah.
We're going to do something about that too. But do you feel like we've missed anything today? I know we could have gone into each, year of your life and unravelled and gone in and gone further. But is there anything else you want people to know?
Well, I want you to know that whatever's going on in your life now, don't be your worst abuser, because that's my story. I sat on a lounge for 10 years in depression with PTSD, feeling sorry for myself. And once I learned that, I had to do something about my situation. So that's the one thing. The second thing is it gets easier. If you start treating it, it does get easier.
You're incredible. What a man. Thank you, Glenn, for being with us on The Deep.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Deep. If it's left you with any burning questions for me or our guests, please hit us up by direct message on Instagram at What's The Deep.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, everybody. It is Zoe here. Change is coming to The Deep. I want to welcome you to Arise. It's uplifting. It's quirky. It's curious. It's all about the mindset and self-discovery to be more helpful and of service. During 16 of The Deep, you'll hear some of these episodes, and I'd love to hear what you think of them over on our Instagram at What's The Deep.